This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. On today's show, I'm reflecting on podcasts from 2016. In past shows like this, I usually try to recap all my new shows from the last year that were not time-sensitive. But for various reasons, I'm not doing it that way. Instead, I'm just spotlighting a few of my shows, while the show notes will list and have links to all the new shows, excluding interviews about events that happened in 2016. Before getting to that, here are a few facts about my shows from 2016. Unlike the past 2 years where I had around 35 new programs each time, I did only 26 podcasts that were completely new. However, I did also share 3 videos from a special conference in Oxford organized by the Inklings Fellowship, and then 13 other podcast programs were presented at my hosting location that were previously unavailable since I moved locations to Podbean in late 2014. So what am I highlighting? While all of the shows I did over the past 12 months were meaningful, there were 3 that stand out as favorites for various reasons. The first is an interview I did with Walter Hooper in his own home. Hooper, while only Lewis's secretary for a short time before Lewis died, has had the most impact on keeping previously released and new content before the public. Next, I picked a panel discussion that I threw together at the last minute after there was the first tangible news in 3 years about the Silver Chair being the next Narnia movie. On August 13th, 2016, just 4 days after that news was presented, I brought together 3 individuals to discuss what it meant and how soon the actual movie might get released. The final selection may seem a little self-serving, and in some ways it is. I'm sharing from my first keynote address that was in April 2016 at the Inklings Fellowship event in Montreat, North Carolina. For each of these 3 shows, I'm providing 2 excerpts, but not back-to-back. That is, I will play a portion from each of the podcasts I just mentioned, and then share another from a different portion of the show after hearing from each of the 3. First up is something from my interview with Walter Hooper, where you'll hear me ask the question. Don't forget that my show notes will provide a link to the complete interview. Do you have any all-time favorite essays by Lewis, or alternatively, what essays just come to the top of your mind that you think readers shouldn't overlook?
Well, I think one that I wouldn't want them to overlook is The Poison of Subjectivism. I believe with Pope Benedict that relativism is one of the great sicknesses of this times that we are in. And it's interesting to me that when Lewis was planning his broadcast talks for the BBC, he was originally asked only to give one series, and then the other series followed. But that one series is about natural law, which is, I know, is a Catholic concept, but he calls it the great moral law, which is the same thing. And it's interesting that he himself knew, I think he was prophetic, in that he guessed that this was going to be a huge problem today, where you find one person saying, but you have your morality, I have mine. That's right for you, but it's wrong for me, and so on. Well, you can't really have anything like a stable society. You can't even have a democracy if, in fact, different people have a different idea of what progress means. But, of course, his great work on that is The Abolition of Man. And when Joseph Ratzinger, as he was then, later became Pope Benedict, when he was in Cambridge in 1988. I wish he had been in Oxford instead of Cambridge, but anyway, at least I could read what he said in his talk. And there, in Cambridge, where he knew Lewis had been a teacher, he talked about the abolition of man, Lewis's work. And I think it's very interesting that he has been thinking along the same lines as Pope Benedict. Pope Benedict is a good deal younger than he is, but not all that much. But they had still solved the same problems ahead.
My second clip again is from my podcast about the Silver Chair being the next Narnia movie, something already known since 2013. In early August 2016, it was announced that TriStar Pictures, a division of Sony Pictures Entertainment, joined with those already committed to making the next Narnia movie. My guests for this podcast were Dr. Devin Brown, author of several books related to Narnia and C.S. Lewis, Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com, and Brian Carnell, also known as Glumpuddle, from NarniaWeb.com. You'll hear me set up the question in a moment. The first to answer is Brian, then Paul, and finally Dr. Brown. One of the comments early on was about what we know is that we don't know still a whole lot, although it's like 90% sure the movie's going to be made. And I think something that a lot of listeners are probably kind of cringing at is the fact that, what, 3 to 4 years? Why in the world would it take so long? Like, say they announce the director the day after this thing, our podcast, is released, and the cast is announced the day after that. You know, within the next 7 days, or before the end of August 2016, we have the director, we have the cast. Would it really take that long, and why would it, for, you know, those of you who are familiar with, you know, all the process?
Well, I guess the short answer is, I mean, they still have to, I mean, you don't just say, oh, let's get these actors. There's a whole process of finding the right actors. And usually the films that have the great cast that you remember, they had to go through a long process to find them. So there's casting, and there's a long period of pre-production of, we have to design and decide what does the world look like. That's a whole process trying to do that. It's a very complicated process that requires a lot of really talented people. And that can take several months or a year, or maybe even longer if it's a more complicated movie. Then filming the movie, something like this, I think Wardrobe took about 7 months to film, for example. This film will probably be a smaller, lower-budget movie, so my guess it won't be that long, but it can definitely take months and months to shoot something. And then there's the period of visual effects and editing and marketing and promotion. It's a really huge – it's honestly a minor miracle that movies get made at all, because it's such a logistical challenge to pull it all together and make it happen. To be honest, I kind of – the more I look at how movies are made, I go, wow, how do they get movies made so fast when there's so much to do?
Yep, exactly. And I mean, someone even said at one point, it's amazing when a movie is made. It's a miracle if a movie is good.
Exactly.
Because of everything that has to go into it.
Yeah, and I mean, as easy as it is to pick apart a movie and say, oh, well, they messed this up and did this wrong. And man, like, it's, yeah, just getting a movie made is such a huge deal. To actually make it good is an amazing accomplishment.
Oh, yeah. And the in casting itself can be arduous, because you not only want to find the right person for the right part, you also have to make sure they have chemistry with everyone else. So let's say if they were recasting like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe again, and they found the right Peter, the right Susan, and the right Edmund, but then they had the perfect people for those parts, but they couldn't find the right Lucy. They would have to keep looking for the right Lucy. Or let's say they found the absolute perfect Lucy, but they had a great Susan, great Peter, great Edmund, but they didn't have chemistry with the perfect Lucy.
Yeah,
they would have to figure out what to do. Maybe recast either the three others or recast the one Lucy. Maybe with someone that's not perfect, but is right with the other three, so that the movie still feels right.
So it's not just casting individual characters, but you got to cast people that work together as well. So it's this really challenging juggling act.
Exactly, and that will be fun to work with and okay to work with for like however long. You're going to be together for the next year or two, doing press tours and all that stuff. So you want people that are kind and that are easy to get along with and get along with everybody and are not kind of like, I want the red M&Ms separated from the blue ones in my dressing room.
and then even with child actors especially, to find an actor that's younger and that still has the stamina and you can sustain their interest and they can still be coming to work every day, giving you a good performance for many months. That's really hard to find a kid that can do that. It's hard enough to find adults that can do that.
Exactly. And be able to do that on take 25.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll add another perspective. I mean, one reason it's taken probably so long to get here is my understanding is once the C.S. Lewis estate unplugged from Walden Media and the people who were making Narnia at that point. I think they had to wait 7 years for the buzz to die down. Otherwise, they would owe some of the money that they hopefully make to some of that buzz belongs to other people. So hence, Dawn Treader came out in 2010. That gets us to 2017. I think no one here thinks there'll be a movie in December 2017. But I'm going to... Paul suggested it might be as late as 2020 before we see Silver Chair. I'm going to go the other direction and say I think it might be as early as Christmas 2018.
Oh.
I would agree with that actually too. Like if they can film in 2017, I think they could have it out by Christmas 2018.
So yeah, I think we're all in agreement that it would be great if within 2 years, 2018. More realistically, it may not be to 2019. If it's not made by 2020, then we probably can move on and safely say that it's not going to be happening. But one of the things you're talking about was... Want to know more about what we know about the Silver Chair movie? Stay tuned and I'll be playing another clip in a bit. Plus, there is a link in the show notes to the complete discussion. That third show I told you is from my first keynote talk. While I've been a speaker before at several Lewis events, this was my first large event where I was a main speaker. For my talk, I expanded on material given in my first book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, which is an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters. In one of my appendices, I listed examples of what I'm calling a secret weapon that Screwtape says is their best tool. Listen now to me setting up this main part of my talk. What is the secret that Screwtape is revealing in these letters? Well, we find that Screwtape, in the fourth letter, he says something, and I am springboarding off of the fourth appendix in my book where I note that this theme that I'm getting ready to reveal more fully is discussed throughout most of the letters. And so I give a listing of it in the appendix. Now, what I'm going to present today is not in the book other than the list in the appendix of the fourth appendix. Okay, without further ado, what is the secret? Screwtape actually boasts quite plainly that their best work is done by keeping things out of a person's mind. If you had a chance to look at the cover of Time magazine, which Lewis was on the cover of Time magazine, I don't know if you noticed this or if you were, maybe you were aware of it beforehand, he was on the cover of Time magazine before Narnia was ever released. He's most known now for Narnia, but in 1947, because of his fame from the Screwtape letters, a new book was coming out, Miracles, but he's on the cover and you have a devil on his left shoulder and an angel's wing over his head, but sort of the right shoulder. But this kind of gives a stereotypical concept about the devil's whispering in your ear, or the angel's trying to get you and they're fighting back and forth. But Screwtape says, no, we're not whispering in ears, we're trying to keep things out of people's mind. That's our best work. And in this letter in particular, he's talking about in the fourth letter, second paragraph, the theme is on prayer, and he's noting that humans constantly forget, which is what they're wanting to promote, keep it out of their mind, that bodily position in prayer does make a difference.
So Screwtape wants to keep this out of your mind. So don't think about it. Okay? Stop thinking. I said stop thinking about that, okay? It's hard to not think about something, right, when you're told not to. All right, but now, as I've already noted, this is not the first time Screwtape has noted this idea about keeping things out of people's mind. He actually, in 24 of the 31 letters, he mentions this idea, or at least makes some inference to it. So the purpose of my talk is to focus in on some of those. I'm going to start at the beginning, and I know I'm not going to get all the way through. I didn't prepare for all of the letters. But we'll get through as many in my notes as possible. But in the first letter, what do we find here? I mentioned about giving you a short summary about the theme. In the first letter, the theme is jargon and real life. These are the key themes. Here at the end of the second paragraph, he states, teach him to call it real life and don't let him ask what he means by real. So that's what Screwtape says. Don't think about what real means. Just, oh, it's whatever's happening to go through your mind that's catching your interest. That's what's real. He doesn't want you to think about spiritual realities and things that will get you to reflect more about your spiritual condition. There are several other themes that are mentioned around this letter as well. And I note in the book, I have anything that's in the topical glossary will be in capitals. So when you're reading along and a word is mentioned, you know, it's easy just to kind of skim by it or whatever. It's like, oh, there's more about that. So you can dig deeper. So change and distraction is something that is going to be in there. Now, in terms of application to our lives, this is that we want to be aware of. The devil wants us to think that what we see is all there is, which, as Christians, we know is not true. If we consider what's real, then we need to see that there is an unseen world, which is, of course, the spiritual realm. In our second letter, the key themes are appearance versus reality. The concept is noted four times.
Are you curious about the rest? While I don't detail all the letters in that talk, you can find out the remaining by following the link in the show notes, where I also give a link to the other new shows that weren't time sensitive. One of those is an academic paper I read at Taylor University, where I picked up where I left off and shared more examples of keeping things out. But today's show isn't over yet. As I mentioned, I'm providing another excerpt from each of the programs. The other clip from my talk with Walter Hooper relates to the collected letters of C.S. Lewis he edited. It's been known that other letters exist from C.S. Lewis that weren't published in that book, but are there enough to publish another volume? Here's part of my question to Walter and his response. Collected letters is something that many people have enjoyed, the fact that it came out the last decade. And it's been, you know, other letters have trickled in and such. And is there any consideration of a fourth volume or a revised all volumes and adding a fourth? I know the third one, the print version, is out of print, but the electronic version is available. Any thoughts about what either you would like to see or what might be possible, or it's what's there is there.
Well, what is sort of on the cards now is the people in Cambridge who did the Lewis books for the same team. They are interested in the collected letters, but they said that if they did it, they would divide it up into six volumes. You know, they don't like these huge 1,400-page books, and you can't. So you can't put it on your stomach without getting indigestion at night. So what they would do is divide it up into six different books. And then perhaps if there's enough letters showing up, and there still are quite a lot, then that might be the seventh volume.
But there's no specific plans at this point.
It's No plans.
Okay. If you've never read or have only read a few of Lewis's letters, then you definitely want to pick up one of those volumes, or who knows, in a few years, there could be reissued in smaller chunks and another volume added. Next up is another clip about the next Narnia movie. That movie has been a long time in the waiting, and as of early 2017, there hasn't been any more substantial news. But why all this waiting in the first place? That's part of what I had my guest address in this excerpt, where Paul Martin, then Brian Cornell, and then Dr. Devin Brown respond. Please note that this portion is almost 15 minutes from the podcast, which was close to an hour long. There's a lot of things that we could speculate about and continue to discuss, but let's turn a corner here. And we've touched on elements about the franchise in general, but let's hit the broader topic of what has happened to the franchise with the, you know, the way The Lion, the Witch, and Wardrobe came out. Everyone seemed to love it to a certain extent, but then by the third one, people were going, oh, really? So who would like to start out with that?
I can start a little bit on that. I'll just cover between Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian. I was talking with one of the producers about it, and he asked me specifically, like, all right, what did I think of the movie? And I grew up watching the BBC ones and the animated version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I hadn't really read the books all that much, like, maybe once. And so I was a fan, but not like a fan of necessarily the books like as much as most people are. I was more of a fan of the BBC stuff, and that's just how I was raised on them. And he asked me, like, what did you think of the movie? And I told him I really liked it. And he said, what do you think the fans are going to think? And I kind of paused, and he said, then he kind of continued, he goes, because we figured we gained their trust enough to change things. And that was, I think, where I was like, well,
oh, wow.
I thought, okay, so you gain the fans' trust with one movie in a seven-movie series, a potentially seven-movie, and then on movie two you decide to change things. That's the problem that I think started to happen. Is that a lot of people, like Prince Caspian, I still think is a really good movie, but was it the Prince Caspian that a lot of people that recognized the name wanted to go see? Probably not. And so they weren't going to trust what was going to come next. So that's why the box office was basically, I mean, it wound up being at the same world with worldwide like box office totals, but in the US, maybe three quarters, I can't remember, might have been half. But trust had been broken by Prince Caspian going into the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That trust could have been brought back, and then it wasn't.
Well, I think there's some truth to that in terms of the fandom. Although I have mixed feelings on Caspian. About half of it I really love, and I love more than anything in Wardrobe. Then about half of it is really questionable decisions, or a lot of it is good decisions with poor execution. I think the reason why Wardrobe, I mean, I think what we, how we got here was we started out with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was a big hit, made $700 million. And the big mistake was that I think Walden and Disney immediately jumped to the conclusion, we've got the next big thing right here. We've got Lord of the Rings. We've got Harry Potter. We've got, and people are jumping up and down waiting for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe 2 to come out. And that really wasn't the case. Although most people, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was, you know, certainly a commercial success and largely a critical success as well. People weren't as excited about to see the sequel, I think, as they kind of thought. And so that led to some poor decisions. I think that's why the movie was undermarketed. Then Walden Media president Michael Flaherty admitted that they thought we just had to tell people this is when it's coming out, and they would go see it. But no, they did need to kind of win people back again because there wasn't as much enthusiasm for a sequel as they kind of thought. So it was undermarketed. I think that's why the budget was so huge, because they thought, we've got the next big thing. We got to make this one bigger and better. And so that made the consequences even greater when it didn't when it didn't perform. And I think even just the story, the movie Prince Caspian assumes, because it's so big, and they try to really delve deeper into the characters, it just seems to kind of pre-assume a level of investment in the world and characters that actually wasn't there as much as the box office numbers indicated.
Yes.
So I think they were really surprised when Caspian didn't perform, and there was a lot of lack of confidence after that of, well, what do we do? What's the right next step? I guess we should try to make it more like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, right? The one that people liked, and how do we do that? And there was a big lack of confidence, and I think that's one of the reasons why Don Treader failed. Not that everyone hated, you know, Caspian and Don Treader. I know you really liked Don Treader, Paul.
A different reason for that, but
and like me, Caspian, like even just as a fan of the books, there's an aspects of it I love, and then certain aspects of it I really, really don't, and I go back and forth on actually if I like Wardrobe or Caspian more.
Yeah,
But I think that's how we got to here, from Wardrobe being a really big hit to is Silverchair going to get made at all kind of question.
Right, and one of the things that one of the marketers that was hired on all three of the films told me at one point was he was given a budget of, I don't want to name exact numbers, but let's say it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. For Prince Caspian, he was given 10, like literally 10% of that budget.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Don Treader, he was given the full amount again. So that what you said was absolutely right. The marketing, they hubris, basically. They thought they had the biggest thing where people would just show up because it's called Narnia.
Uh-huh.
And that's literally what happened. And then, yeah, what you said about me enjoying the Don Treader a lot, I got engaged on the Don Treader to my now wife. So that kind of...
Good memories.
My perspective of it, because I got to visit the set, I got to meet the cast and all this stuff. It does color your vision of the final product at the end. Like, there's no two ways about it. Like, I think if anybody had been to the set, they would have been like, yes, this movie's brilliant. I love it, you know, that kind of thing. It just kind of, it colors your perspective of everything, because there are parts that you recognize that you watched them film and stuff. And you're like, wow, I was there. And it just, in your mind, you can't separate yourself from that. Watching a movie, like, you were there. It was, there's an experience there that adds to it. So, yeah. It's kind of a not fair way to look at a movie. So, but yeah, that was my experience.
Well, Devin, how about you? What's your thoughts about the franchise? Yeah,
I find that once you start making lists of what you liked and didn't like, there seems to be some things we might agree on, and then at some point it just ravels off into all sorts of idiosyncratic, well, I like this, oh, I didn't like that, or that was my favorite thing. You know, Tolkien has that line in the second preface, second forward to Lord of the Rings. He said, I've gotten all sorts of letters from all sorts of people for all sorts of changes. And what I find is that the very thing one person says I'd like more of, the other one says I'd like less of. And so I know there's a lot of preferences. I will say this, though, that my sense is if you look at the things that didn't work for people, if you started talking to a lot of people, there's more departures from the book that are on the bad list than not. I think a lot of people, certainly there are some changes that seem to work okay, but anytime you go away from a great story to say, well, I think I could improve on Lewis here in a major way, not sort of an adaptive way, but a major way by adding some whole new element, the idea that you can improve Lewis is very risky business, and I think should be done very carefully. I mean, if you're going to change it, you'd think you'd at least change it for the better. And I think all four of us can think of some changes that, man, that was like worse than anything. Why would you do that? So, the other thing I'll throw in, which no one's mentioned, you know, my wife always warns me, not everybody's as into C.S. Lewis and Narnia as you are, including her, right? and so the idea that, I don't know, what percentage of people will have read The Silver Chair who go to see it? And surely they want to have as broad of an audience. That's one thing everyone knows, is they want all the fans to go. They want all the non-fans to go. They want all the serious believers to go. They want all the not-so-serious believers. They want everybody to go. And so to make a movie for everyone or is going to be not possible, but as broad as they can go is probably a valuable thing. And that's kind of tricky business, but I'll just say this. One of the factors that we haven't mentioned is how many people have, not us, have read just Lion Witch. Mm-hmm. If you look at just book sales alone, that also tells you a story that way more people have read Lion Witch and knew it and wanted to go see it. Fewer people had read Caspian. And interestingly, about the same number had read Dawn Treader, which kind of bared exactly up with what the take was at the marketplace.
Yep.
So that's another aspect. I don't know how big to make it. Obviously, if it's a great movie, everybody's going to go see it. And so I guess that would be my main thing is, you mentioned execution. Whatever you do, it's got to be done really great.
Right. And what, on that note, too, based on the numbers I got from Michael Flaherty way back, the Magician's Nephew book has sold about as many copies as The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, probably because they reordered everything, but also probably also because, I mean, I read that in school. I also read The Last Battle in school as in junior high as part of just our required reading in class and everything. So that might add to that. And The Silver Chair, as far as publication goes, from his numbers back then, about 10 years ago, was the lowest selling of the Narnia books, which is why there was all the dispute of which movie to go with next.
Yeah,
Silverchair, Magician's Nephew.
Yeah, and I think, let's be realistic here. As far as audiences, I think most of the people that are going to buy tickets are people that are at least not very familiar with the books. Those are the people that are really going to pay the bills. And I do think, though, like it is a problem, you know, when you're trying to go so broad and please as many groups as you can and their dog, that's when I think you get so many, and especially when there's a lot of money on the line, that's when, you know, you start second guessing yourself and bringing in other writers, and there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And I think one reason to be optimistic about Silverchair is we are expecting a smaller Narnia movie. We're expecting, I think, kind of less money on the table, fewer cooks in the kitchen, and I think they can afford to not have to necessarily be as broad as the other movies did as far as their target audience goes. So I think that will help them creatively. I kind of feel one of the problems with the first three films is they're just a little too big, and they're trying too hard to be that Lord of the Rings influence is there, where they're trying a little too hard to be big and giant and epic, and that's why, you know, in Dawn Treader, you couldn't just have the Dawn Treader going off because it's the honorable thing to do, to right the wrong that, you know, that Miraz made to banish the Seven Lords. It can't just be about honor and adventure and seeking the unknown. It has to be about saving the world. And I think you don't feel as much pressure to do things like that when you have maybe a more specific audience in mind. And I think that the Silver Chair and really a lot of the Narnia books, yeah, maybe they have a battle or two or a huge landscape or whatever here and there, but I think of them as fairly small, intimate fairy tales. And so I think that having fewer Legos to work with for the Silver Chair, I think will be a big benefit to them creatively and not having to worry about as broad of an audience.
Yeah, and here's the paradox there, is by going for a more specific, smaller audience, you might make a better film that will, in fact, please a broader audience. It's an odd paradox, but, you know, make a great film, and people will go see it.
Well, there's, I'm sure, a lot of stuff to have. Again, you can hear the complete interview if you want to know more about what we know and why by following the link in the show notes. Finally, my last clip is from my talk at the Inklings Fellowship. This selection is from the very beginning of my talk, where I spend about 5 minutes giving an overview of my book, C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters.
I want to note some of the unique things about my book. One of the things I did when reflecting on, like, there are quite a few study guides already out there for the Screwtape Letters. So I thought, in terms of referencing things, I want to be able to, you know, not just say, okay, in the 13th letter, you know, you'll find this. I want you to, and if you've looked at the book, you already are aware of this, to take your copy of the Screwtape Letters and number the paragraphs, because I reference them by paragraph to help you more specifically locate certain things within the book. So that's one of the unique aspects. In addition to giving you questions, and I'll note about how that's unique in terms of not done before with other study guides. I do give suggested answers. Now, I've seen at least one that did that, but mine's one of the few, or only the second one. I include that toast essay that I just was showing you here for the Saturday Evening Post. That essay is actually 5 times the length of your average letter. And then I have a short and long summary for each letter. If you're doing a study, whether it by group, and I do have in the beginning of the book, if you're deciding to do it in a group setting and you're limited to 13 weeks, I have a suggested order to group the letters that will be the best to go by. Now, maybe you have to go shorter. I was talking with someone, and they said, well, I only have 6 weeks. Well, you can double up then, I guess. But, you know, it's long and hard to kind of do one letter a week, although you can not exhaust the letters by the amount of information Lewis packs in to do a lengthier study, probably more so on your own. When doing a study, whether in group or on your own, I give a short summary of what the themes, major themes are in the letters. And then in the third section of the book, I give a longer list of the concepts that I felt that somebody, you know, just using it for the first time, they probably didn't want to overexpose themselves or cheat. But it was a nice summary for after the fact to remind you down the road, but initially to enable you to dig it out yourself more so. The study guide, it's very flexible. You can do either a short or individual or long or group. I have 5 questions in each to where you can do the 5, you know, for the short, and then the 5 more questions. But within each of the 5, the first 3 are the major questions. Now, if you're leading a group, you can pick any questions you want. But if you're short on time, you don't get a chance to preview it maybe, you can just pick the first 3 if you're doing the group, and then the second group of 3, and then the end 2 for each of the sets can be optional and are typically more reflective in nature. The major thing that makes the book stand apart is something, I don't know if we created a combination word here, a topical glossary. How many of you have seen Paul Ford's Companion to Narnia? It's a nice, massive, you know, there's 7 books for Narnia. It's a great resource to, you know, remind yourself about the different themes and such, characters and whatnot. And so I thought, well, Screwtape is obviously a very short book, but there are themes that run through the letters, not each letter, but like he talks about something over here and then it's back over there. So I bring that together in short little entries that are not really encyclopedic, but I guess they're encyclopedic in nature. So that makes it unique. And then you can, independently of any formal study, use the book. But of course, you do need to benefit the greatest from a book is to have the Screwtape letters. But you could casually look at the topical glossary and go, oh, okay. And then you go read a letter. Or you're reading a letter and you go, oh, I wonder where else you might talk about that. Finally, there are also several appendices in the book. I give a list of different 60 facts or trivia about it, and then I share an adaptation transcript of a talk I gave to a group that wasn't expected to have known anything about the Screwtape letters, but it also serves, for someone who has read it, a reminder about some of the great themes in it. So that's one of the many and appendices. What I shared last year, I was talking about having, you know, poetry reading or some type of reading. I shared something that's in the book last year, the Screwtape Speaks at Demon Chapel that I did as an original piece last year.
So there you have it. Excerpts from 3 of the shows from 2016 that are special to me. Be sure to go to those show notes that I've been telling you about throughout the program to see a listing of all the different interviews that I did that weren't time sensitive. One of those interviews was about a book that was a winner in Christianity's Today 2017 Book Awards. That was a book called 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know, the author Terry Glaspie. I spoke with him in early 2016. So where can you get those show notes? Well, if you don't know already, you can go to the Podbean location. That's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Or you can visit essentialcslewis.com, where you can not only get to hear about the latest podcast, which is featured on the main page, but also daily quote and fact about C.S. Lewis. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of All About Jack. Thanks for listening.